You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is the novelist and poet Charlie Smith. He's the author, most recently, of a novel called Chimney Rock from Henry Holt, and of a book of poems called The Palms, which was recently published by Norton. His other books of fiction include a trio of novellas, Crystal River, and three novels, The Lives of the Dead, Shine, Hawk, and Canaan. The other two books of poetry are Indistinguishable from the Darkness and Red Roads. Well, first of all, I want to talk about, I guess, what people like John Hawkes and Nathaniel West and Flannery O'Connor have called the topology of violence, because while most of Chimney Rock takes place in Southern California and Mexico, the place named in its title is, of course, not here, but where?
It's in Nebraska.
Right, and it seemed to me to be a metaphor for what is left after everything gets whittled away or eroded or scarred. It's a hinge place. It's a formation of rock. And so it seemed to me that this book, like other things of yours, is the construction of a place of ultimacy, not like Los Angeles, but a place that you would like, in fact, to see.
Mm. Yes, that's accurate. That's good. I think one of the things that interests me in terms of writing novels is how the genre, the form, can be used wholly as an act of imagination. That my interest in it is, to a great degree, in being able to develop and imagine worlds that don't necessarily exist. I'm not exactly sure why I'm pulled in that direction, but I know that I'm not interested in a kind of regularized representation of reality. That's not really interesting to me. But what the imagination represents, what it comes up with, is very interesting to me, because it seems to me that we're often kind of bamboozled and befuddled by what we take to be the kind of harsh concreteness and abruptness and aggressiveness of what we take to be the real world, while underneath that is this continuous kind of evolving imagination that's going on in all of us, that is clearly what we're all able to draw from and relate to among each other, regardless of this other kind of surface reality.
So it seems to me that, for instance, Nathaniel West in Day of the Locust is talking about a Los Angeles that he was living in and whose flatness and bluntness and implicit violence under the surface he was basically nauseated by, or at least he was a man, if to invert Henry James, be a man upon whom nothing fails to nauseate. You know, how can I be sick of whatever it is I find to see, seems to be the West question. Whereas here, the Los Angeles in this book seems to be vitalizing, one, because it is not this Los Angeles, but is Los Angeles as a metaphor for a place where the imagination can project the forbidden.
Yes, that's true. I think that's a good perception of it, that my own understanding of the real Los Angeles is limited, but I'm interested in being able to use it as a kind of source and means. The novels I've written before this novel take place for the most part in the South, though they move inside the novel to other places. But what I discovered about using the South was that people tend to have a perception of it, especially people who are not from there, as a specific kind of place that has quite a bit of leeway in terms of action and thought. Things can happen there that they feel can't happen in their own homes or in their own towns. And so for me as a novelist, it turned out to be a means whereby I could explore things that were interesting to me, but put them in this milieu, in this place, so that they had a kind of sense of veracity to them that came in a way with the place. In Los Angeles, Hollywood, that whole kind of fantasia that we all carry in our minds, especially for people who are not from there, became for me a means to do this, to explore things that were interesting to me without having to make another planet.
So the goddess of this kind of imagination seems to be the woman in the book, Chimney Rock, Zebra Dunn. She is renamed as a movie star. And her quality, one that the men have to, in a way, emulate, is her ability to say anything at all, to create in her conversation or rambles or memory anything that her imagination offers her, whereas the men seem to have to first defeat reality before they can enter the imagination. They seem to have to kill each other, whereas Zebra is living a kind of existence like a commentator on autism. She's explaining what goes on in her internal world as if she were an autistic who had the language to ventilate that world.
I think it's a very, there's a small and single governor that's missing in her, but it's a very small thing. But I think that it's one that autistic could be a word to describe someone without that governor. But I don't really see her in that sense, because I think all of us live very close to that sort of edge. We, in some sense, we live in that way because we're all in our own heads telling ourselves stories about who we are and what the world is and where we come from and where we should have come from. And we find out all the time that other people are not perceiving us in quite this way, that even the facts of our own lives that we're sure of when we present them to someone else are sometimes challenged as being accurate. I've gone back a few years ago. I went back to see an old girlfriend who I'd gone with in college 20 years ago, and I carried to my meeting with her a whole series of facts of what had happened to us. And when I told her these things, she had other facts for the same experiences. And Zebra Dunn is someone who is interesting to me in terms of this kind of possibility of taking this kind of capacity, this tendency that all of us have in our own lives, and just taking off that particular latch that separates us from actually living that way and seeing what happens.
Well, I was very much put in mind, you know, these books of yours are frequently described as eatable, but I was reminded of something that René Girard said about Freud. He said, Freud never exactly understood that Oedipus didn't have an Oedipus complex. He didn't want to murder his father and sleep with his mother. He did. And that there's a world of difference between the desire and the act. In this book, certainly the murder of the father and the sexual struggle is literalized. The father has, to some extent, presided over the murder of a younger brother, the death of a younger brother, and he is now in the act of taking the other son's wife. A good deal of very literal-minded phallicism occurs, presaged by the arrival in a car window of a snake while the father, Clement, is eating a sandwich, and the father's response is to grab the snake and twist its head off. I wondered about this literalizing quality of desire.
Well, it's one of the things that's in the book. I don't first come up with symbols, metaphors, or anything that's standing in for something else when I'm writing a book. I write out of the deepest sources of my imagination I can get to. And Clement in this book is, in some ways, what he's doing is that he's a great both preventive and actualizing force. That in his own life, He's a hugely actualizing force. I mean, this is a book about people who are extremely successful at what they do. They're people who are extremely hardworking and capable at what they do. They're people who have pressed themselves in such a way so that they have, either by design, ability, luck, endurance, whatever, pushed through the kinds of barriers that most of us don't push through. And by in doing this, the book, in some ways, one of the things that it does is it explores the consequences of this. And in terms of it meaning something in terms of symbol or metaphor, those are things, I think, that in some sense come from the outside of the book. But they're applicable because all of our lives, deeply lived, resonate with myth. It's unavoidable. But it's not something that, as a writer, that I've imposed on it and said, okay, this is something that stands for, you know, an Oedipal aggression of some kind.
No, I know that, but and yet at the same time I would differ with you slightly, because I would say that, if anything, what the book lacks is a sense of reality. I didn't think of these people, you know, these are not people who could or would be film directors, actors, mm-hmm. actresses, silent movie stars, grips, or anything else. They are in a Hollywood of the mind in which the book works, when it works, it seems to me, as psychodrama.
Mm-hmm.
But not a psychodrama based on any literal surface of activity. You have to, mm-hmm. in a certain sense, it's a great Hollywood novel for people who don't live here,
mm-hmm.
because you have to surrender what you know of the world in order mm-hmm. to believe this book.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably a good insight into it. But it's part of the design in of the book, the interest that I have in writing it is to create a situation that lives in its own terms. I feel my obligation as a writer is to make it come alive on the page. It's not to represent reality. However, hopefully the world that's created in this book is fully inhabited by the people in the world of that book. And that's the obligation as far as I see it. As far as someone being able to use this as a map for getting around the movie industry, that's another thing.
Oh, no, I don't mean that. I mean that there will be, at least for this reader, there was an ongoing arm wrestle with what I know about people and what I know about the world
mm.
and the world as it's being represented here.
Sure.
Mm. And so for me, I found Zebra being, in a way, the presiding intelligence. You can accept this
mm-hmm.
if you accept her model, that mm-hmm. anything can be said as true and that its truth value is not to be contested because it's simply presented. It's not being, it's affirmed, but mm-hmm. not affirmed as evidence.
Mm. Yeah, it's that's true. That's so. At the same time, one of the things that Zebra, part of her genius is not just this presentation of an endless string of purported facts, but in the way she's able to present them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she presents them with a kind of authenticity and concreteness and specificity that at least, hopefully, brings them across as being real. That when she, somewhere in the book, describes being born in Maine and her childhood there, she describes it in the way that people, to a certain extent, would describe their childhood, the peripheral but intense memories that we have of our childhoods that have very little to do with maybe what was actually going on, but things that she could remember, the salt water in the swimming pool instead of chlorinated water, things like that, a flag flapping on a flagpole, the color of the shutters of her house, things like that. This is, I think, the genius of her. It's not simply that she claims that she's from this place or that place. Any of us could do that in a bar room, you know, and many people do get a little drunk and make claims about our lives. But she's making claims that seem to be claims that she can back up.
Well, she seems to be like Circe, you know, that there's a kind of act of transformation going on in her language that gives her access to an alternate reality. Mm. And if you love her, of course, you enter that reality.
Mm.
Women function in your books in this manner as reshapers of the imaginative process. And I've always wondered, you know, that femme fatale thing, does it have a reality for you, or is it insinuating in on a more theoretical basis?
Well, I suppose, at least in terms of what I write down, is that I tend to like women with dash and verve.
Uh-huh.
I tend to like women with muscle, women who are able to use their lives as a means for making things. And the women I write about tend to be women of that ilk. They're women of great power. They're women who exist. I mean, after all, the situation in the world is that you know, that women are often in a situation where they're having to seek power that is not first theirs, it's someone else's. And the women I write about tend to be women who have, to some extent, embraced that problem, that situation. They are able to take on the situation as it is and make something of it. And what they make of it is, to me, not necessarily something that you could put, say, strictly in the arms of women, is that you could put in the arms of people who are creative and transforming. The men tend to be this way also, but in perhaps a different kind of way, because the men are born into a particular milieu that in some sense the women are not. And however, the both tend to be groups, at least in my books, who are capable and achieving in these areas. And perhaps the men in some ways are more short-sighted than the women in my books. I mean, the men sometimes tend to take the obligations of the world, or the world that they were brought up in at least, or have thrived in, seriously in a way. It takes them longer to realize that these aren't so serious, that they're deeper imperatives than worldly achievement.
I'm talking to Charlie Smith, the author most recently of the novel Chimney Rock, published by Henry Holt. This book, more than anything else, reminded me of The Tempest, that these are figures for the workings of the imagination.
That's good.
Ways in which the imagination is presided over or made available.
Yes, that's good. Yeah, that is good, because it does... The imagination comes through in these various ways. I mean, it's like rivers coming into the ocean, to a bay, that one runs smoothly, one doesn't. But these are ways that it comes through, and it comes through in these ways, because even if you take somebody like Will Blake, who says all through the book that he drifts, that this is what he has wanted to do. He's drifted into his own celebrity, into his own abilities, into his own achievements. But this also is a way the imagination moves, that it moves in this way, lying on a sofa looking at the wind blowing in the trees, as well as moving, at just as Clement describes it and experiences, through battering and brutality.
One of the poems in your most recent book of poetry, The Palm, seems to be a direct relative of the activity in Chimney Rock, and I thought I would ask you to read that.
All right.
This is Charlie Smith reading the title poem, The Palms, from his new book, The Palms.
When the sun went down in L.A. that day, I was driving a rental car east on Sunset Boulevard, worn down by the endless internal battering, and looked back to see the vivid, capacious, burned oceanic light, the dust in the air that made the light palpable and beautiful, hanging over the pastel city. And saw the crunched little stores with their brocades of steel locking them up, and the narrow streets springing downhill like madmen running away. and there was a ridge that blocked the sun, a scruffy, torn wall of yellow earth with a few small houses on top, widely spaced, disconnected looking, though down from them there was a neighborhood of bunched-up shacks and a street that wound through patches of willow and bougainvillea. And on the ridge that was sharply defined by the rotted, unmanageable light, there were a few palm trees, untouched at that moment by breeze, so that their tops hung limply. And they seemed black against the huge sky of Los Angeles, like small dark thoughts tethered at the end of reason's thick ropes, hanging there in gratuitous solitude, like the thoughts of a man behind a cluttered restaurant counter who speaks no English, wearing a hat made of butcher paper, who slaps and slaps his small daughter until they both are stunned, stupid, and helpless, overwhelmed by their lives.
Charlie Smith reading the title poem, The Palms, from his book, The Palms. I wanted to ask you finally about, it was not difficult for me, although you're very different writers, to think about the poetry of Dennis Johnson and his novels, or the poetry of Malcolm Lowry and his great novel, Under the Volcano. And I wondered whether you think there is such a creature as the poet novelist.
I don't know if there is. I don't see myself as a poet novelist. I see myself as a person who writes poems full time and writes novels full time. I've done it that way since the beginning. Dennis and I have been friends for a long time, since we were both starting out in some ways. And for me, it's two ways of going at it. And I think to some degree, because I did it from the beginning without anyone telling me I couldn't or that I should stop, I've continued. And the reason I continue is that I continue to make discoveries in both genres.
It's a very interesting thing because, you know, my most secret novels, the ones that I care for and can't tell anyone to read, are frequently the novels by poets. I'm a great fan of that strange book, Appendix A, by Hayden Carruth. It's a very odd novel. Mm-hmm. Cannell's novel, Black Light, and others. And there does seem to be a very different kind of novel writing that goes on. There are novels by poets who've never written poetry, of course. It seems to me that Nightwood is one such, you know, although Juno Barnes did, in fact, write some poetry, but it's a whole different sphere, it seems to me.
Well, they're both, the genres are extremely different. I mean, really simply, I mean, the novels are about story and poems are about words and about language itself. And the transfer, at least my experience of it, is a transfer from poetry to fiction rather than the other way. For the most part, in terms of how it affects what you have when you wind up with a novel, because with a poem, what you're trying to do is to make this formal, impassioned, compressed vocalization, and that's really not what's required in a novel. It's in a novel what is required is a very authentic representation of character and story moving through time, and that's not necessary for a poem. And so you don't have to bring that over. It's possible in narrative poetry, some of my poetry is narrative poetry, to bring over that ability to move through space and time into a poem. But when you bring it the other way, what you're bringing into a novel is something that novels don't require. They simply don't require the sort of compression that's necessary. They don't require impassioned speech. They don't require formal speech in the same way. But when you move it over into a novel, what you can do, since you're using language, is that you can bring that into the making of the sentences that make up the novel. And so they can have an effect that, if you're good at it or you're lucky or you stick with it, can produce an extra charge in a sentence and make it possible to make a sentence, make a paragraph, make the book itself resonate in an extra way. I mean, there are novelists who have done that in novels without themselves being active poets or significantly active poets, I think. I mean, it's not remarked on much, but Hemingway is one who does that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Hemingway understands that each word is a discrete entity in a way, say, that Faulkner did not. And what makes, I think, at the center of Hemingway's prose a world of genius is that if you take a Hemingway sentence, the sentences tend to be made up of words that in themselves exist without relation to the other words in the sentence. But they're put together in such a way so that in their joinings there's a spark that shoots up between the words. It's extremely powerful and it's not reproducible. It's why with the thousands of imitators of Hemingway, no one gets it, because they don't quite understand the way that he has taken the words that have no relation to each other and put them together. Whereas with a writer like Faulkner and a number of other novelists, I mean, Faulkner is much more like other novelists, say, than Hemingway is, I think. Faulkner has an arcing sense of movement towards something in the sentences, so that the words come together and they move in together as the sentence moves, which is a novelistic way of going about writing using words. And some novelists can be aware of that, but if it's a poet who has at the same time surrendered to the requirements and responsibilities of writing a novel, that when someone asks me what you need to watch out for, what you need to do when you're making a novel, as simply as I can tell them is that everything you do in a novel has to either deepen the character, move the story, or both. That you take that on as a requirement. It's like defensive driving. you have to be aware that this is what you're doing. And once you surrender to that, you have extreme leeway in what you do. And so you can then bring in what is learned from poetry. The problem some poets have who try to write novels is they don't accept that obligation initially. And so they bring in the abilities and means of poetry. But what you have is just kind of baskets filled with beautiful flowers. But these flowers are not being taken anywhere.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Charlie Smith, the author of the novel Chimney Rock, recently published by Henry Holt. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books. Too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.